Hello and welcome. Foreign policy has been one of Prime Minister Modi's top priorities in his 3 years in office, and this is appropriate given the political and economic volatility in international affairs. As a large country with a fast-growing economy, the world's second-largest army, nuclear weapons and long-range missiles, the idea of India in 2017 is that India has no choice but to be a major force in international affairs. Prime Minister Modi came into office unencumbered by the burden of either the Nehruvian foreign policy that had guided India for half a century or Dr. Manmohan Singh's somewhat modified version of it, which was in place for the previous decade. As Prime Minister Modi returns home after a historic visit to Israel and attending the G20 summit in Hamburg, 3 years into office, the Modi government faces a changed geopolitical terrain marked by the election of Donald Trump as the U.S. president. We now have an unpredictable United States, an aggressive China. Meanwhile, the India-China standoff at the Northern Trijunction in Doklam bordering Bhutan has brought divisions of the armies of both countries face to face. In this program, we're going to be looking at the strategic shifts in India's foreign policy under Prime Minister Narendra Modi's leadership, the opportunities they present, and the risks they pose. Joining us on the show, former Foreign Affairs Minister Salman Khurshid, former diplomat and author Pawan Varma. He's been India's envoy to Bhutan and Cyprus. He is the General Secretary of the JDU, Dr. Shilkant Sharma. From 2008 till 2011, he was the former Secretary General of SAARC. He's also the former permanent representative of India to the UN in Vienna and the IAEA. Jyoti Malhotra, senior journalist specializing in foreign policy. Justin Rowlett, South Asia correspondent of the BBC. We have Bharat Karnad, professor of National Security Studies, Center for Policy Research, and the author most recently of Why India is Not a Great Power Yet. And Dhruv Jayashankar, fellow for foreign policy at the Brookings Institution India Center in New Delhi. I want to start with some opening comments from our panelists. Let's go across to Salman Khurshid first. Mr. Khurshid, the Prime Minister has visited over 60 countries since 2014. In terms of foreign policy achievements, where does India stand today, 3 years into this government's tenure? Because the headline images of this week have been two, one positive, one negative. First, of course, the Indian Prime Minister in Israel, and the latter being Indian and Chinese forces face-to-face in Doklam.
Well, clearly, that's a lot of energy, frankly. One must grant that to the Prime Minister. It's an enormous amount of energy. But this kind of solo flights that he's making, it seems that the rest of his government is not seemingly involved as generally in such matters governments are involved. But be that as it may, it's his style and it's his government, and he has a mandate to work in the manner that he pleases. But given that so much energy has been pumped into foreign policy, I don't see major achievements that we can write home about. I think that you've just mentioned things about the U.S., about China, things about our neighborhood. We could even look at our inability to carry matters in the manner that we would want to in many parts of the world, simply because despite having all the prowess that you've mentioned, it doesn't translate into acceptable articulation in the world. And I'm not quite sure that in our foreign policy we understand anything that the world wants to do. We certainly know very well what we require and what we want to do, but are we willing to spend a little time on what the world wants, right or wrong from our point of view, so that we can approach it in a manner that is meaningful and effective?
All right. Mr. Karnad, you heard Mr. Khurshid over there. He's saying this is about optics, there's showmanship perhaps, but there's no real substance.
Yeah, that's precisely what's wrong with the Indian foreign policy, what he said. The fact is we should not do or try to do whatever it is the world wants. We have to pursue our own interests. You see, we try to cater to all kinds of interests all over the place and try to be nice and be seen as nice and responsible and so on and so forth. In the bargain, your national interests are invariably hostage to other people's expectations. That's been the main problem. The other thing is, I don't think we quite understand, MEA understands, or the MOD, or the government for that matter, understands hard power. There's no appreciation of hard power. The capabilities we have are inappropriate for great power. that we seek in theory, and we somehow expect that being whale-sized is enough to get you great power status.
Are you talking about economically?
You are a trillion-dollar economy, but as I said, you are whale-sized with the impact of a minnow. Minnow is a small fish. You haven't had the right policies throughout. You've just had reforms since 1992, and then you haven't really progressed fast enough. The administrative system is what it is. Full of shackles and barriers and red tape, it's still all there. The ease of doing business, I think we are still way down in the list. So, I mean, then we expect the world to invest here, and our prime minister goes to all over the globe trying to attract monies for investment. Nobody's going to invest if the milieu is not conducive. Licenses take forever. There's still the license raj. So how do we expect to get from here to there without doing all the things to get from here to there?
So is this government any different from the previous government?
No, it's not. I mean, this is the great disappointment, I think, because Mr. Modi promised a lot. He did, with his various slogans, not least of which was
maximum government, minimum governance.
So these are the sorts of things, I think. And in foreign policy, he has pretty much followed the line that the previous governments had laid down. True, he's a far greater backslapper and hugger and embracer of foreign leaders than our previous prime ministers. And that's, of course, awkward for many Western leaders who, you know, naturally feel a bit discomfited. But that said, I think he had Trump on the back foot, actually, with the embrace, even though Trump was told that this is what you should expect. So this is a wonderful thing that he imposed himself physically on Trump, who's about 6 feet three or whatever. But our prime minister is 56 inches chested, so I think that won over. But it's a wonderful thing, though. But the point to make really is this. Substantively, again, in the United States, did we get what we want? I think Trump got most of the substantive issues that he wanted to push. We didn't. We got the embrace and the hug.
Dr. Sharma, then will you respond to that? What did India get from the visit to the United States, apart from the optics of the hugs and the big event, like we've had Madison Square Garden in the past, all of that, that makes for great show, but what does India get away?
The MSG show was 3 years back.
Of course.
And the present visit. Now, at that time when Prime Minister Modi went, he was a new leader of our country with a vast, massive majority behind him. And he let the diaspora identify with him. So that time, when he captured the imagination of the people in New York or wherever he went in the US and subsequently, that was a phenomenon, because these people who had gone to America, they had stood in queues overnight for long years, for visas, and they had reached there, built themselves up from their own bootstraps. And here was a prime minister who went straight to them, identified with them. He told them that I have visited America like you, and I have traveled here for 6 months like you do. So there was an instant identification. So that resonance in MSG was different. Today, Trump has given a different message. But the achievement of this present visit was that all the apprehensions and the uncertainties about Trump's approach to India, they were to a large extent put to rest. There were a lot of stories that the Pakistanis are again worming their way into it, and they might get into the Trump bandwagon, and they might start talking like, if you remember 2009 when Obama had come, he had started talking about AFPAC, and this fellow Richard Holbrooke came to South Asia trying to give a new dimension. But we resisted that at that time. Similar fears were again on the horizon. But Prime Minister Modi's visit was successful in that sense, that the fears were put to rest.
Jyoti, is that the message we got from the visit with President Trump? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, on the campaign trail, it seemed like President Trump was on a collision course, or to be president was on a collision course with China, but that seems to have changed. We've had the Mar-a-Lago summit with President Xi. Trump seems to have agreed that the U.S. needs China for various reasons, whether it's to counter North Korea, whether it's for its own economic health, whether it's the Trump family's own personal investments in China. So is that really the message that we got from that visit?
I think, Sarah, that you have to admire Prime Minister Modi's ambition. There's no question about that, and his energy and his drive. And when he goes to the U.S., or when he went to the U.S. recently, as you saw, the Indian side deliberately sort of underplayed the visit, because Trump is an unpredictable sort of chap,
right,
and you don't know what you can expect from him. But from all accounts, it seems to have gone off very well, public as well as sort of people who speak off the record. But I'm just wondering, so here, yes, and he's he's the Hamburg visit or the G20 visit, where he sort of met Xi Jinping for a few minutes. I think, and you also spoke in your introduction about the face-off in Doklam. Now, what has been interesting in the last few months is that the Prime Minister has clearly brought down the rhetoric on China, and you saw that in Astana at the margins of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is very different from a year ago when he asks Xi Jinping for India's membership into the NSG. Now, so in a sense, I think right now the face-off at the Doklam in the Himalayas is, we don't know what's really happened, but the fact is that the Indian Prime Minister is not backing down. So I think that's also interesting. The other point that I'd like to make is, later on this year, there will be the SAARC summit, which was canceled last year, you remember, Sarah, not only by India, but there were four countries in the region that told Pakistan that we are not coming to the summit. So the summit was off. That question will come up again in front of the Prime Minister. What is India going to do? Are you going to say, we are not going to Pakistan again? So the point that I'm trying to make is, what does India do with the region? You can make friends with Donald Trump. Of course, you have to make friends with Donald Trump. He is a very, very powerful leader. You are you are telling the Chinese that we are the other Asian power that you cannot ignore, and you can be as aggressive as you want in the Himalayas and the South China Sea or elsewhere, with the Chinese, the party Congress coming up. But what does India do with its region? And it's not only about Pakistan. I just want to point out also that
you're saying the neighborhood first.
The neighborhood
policy,
is
the basic pillar of one of
What's,
their the foreign
the
policies.
Maldives,
not work.
In the Maldives, for example, earlier in July, the opposition, 45 MPs, a four-party coalition, came together and are now in a majority. But India continues to support the ruling party, the ruling government in power. That is going to be very embarrassing for India if this opposition coalition impeaches the speaker. So I'm not sure that India has its eye on the ball in the Indian Ocean region, in the Maldives especially. So I think you have to look at your own region first and see what's going on in the region. And you must make friends, of course, with the rest of the world. But let's not forget what's happening in South Asia.
Mr. Varma, Jyoti says that India's not backing down when it comes to China. You've been envoy to Bhutan. While she says the Prime Minister is not backing down, we've heard some very strident comments coming in from the Chinese side. And opposed to that, on the contrary, we're seeing this deafening silence coming in on the Indian side. You think that's a strategic decision?
India is not backing down as of now, but India's track record in dealing with an aggressive China has not been very impressive. And I would say that when China, for instance, ordained that people from Arunachal Pradesh will get stapled visas, I would think any self-respecting country would say that in that case, Chinese of Tibetan origin would get stapled visas. When China prevents us from looking for oil in South China Sea or makes the task difficult, I think we should have been asking the question over years, why China has invested billions in POK, Pak-occupied Kashmir. It's declared an internationally disputed area, while the South China Sea is not. So whether it's on these issues or other matters, China has blocked our membership of the NSG. China has refused to give Azhar the tag that the UN wants to give him. So I think that the time has come for India to understand, and particularly where Doklam is concerned. I have some other general comments on foreign policy as such. But since you asked me in the specific context of the face-off now between India, China, where Bhutan is involved in the very strategically important area of the Doklam plateau, I am saying to you categorically that if India doesn't stand by Bhutan here, And if India doesn't stand for its own strategic interests here, we will be making a big mistake. And it's time to tell China that aggressive, intimidatory language used repeatedly will not necessarily make for a weak-kneed India, but we also have a prime minister who in his eloquence is often muscular, but in his actions is less so. We saw it with Pakistan, where his speeches in 2014 were that he would put Pakistan in its place immediately. How much he has succeeded in doing so, we have seen now, notwithstanding the surgical strike. And there has been an incoherence as far as policy in the neighborhood is concerned, which needs rectification. With Pakistan, with China, an example was mentioned by Jyoti of Maldives. I think that we need to focus on our own areas. There have been some pluses, certainly, with other countries. Because, you know, foreign policy is a continuum. It represents a national consensus. It's not as if the BJP will come to power, wave a magic wand, and completely change the contours that should define your foreign policy. But in general, I will say that in foreign policy, you do not go by the optics, but by the outcomes. And here he seems to have made a great impact on the Indian diaspora. But we are still assessing the outcomes.
Dhruv, China hasn't, historically, they haven't really had any opposition to the NSG. Unlike, let's say, countries like Japan, historically, they have an opposition to the spread of nuclear weapons. So why do you think this new stand? Clearly, there's something behind the scenes.
I mean, I think there's a broader issue at play here related to China's rise, to India-China relations, and in some ways the longer question, the larger question of Indian foreign policy. India is a young country, like the people in the room, but its foreign policy is still governed by an older generation. It is still dictated by the fears and the insecurities of that older generation. And everything I've heard so far in this debate is an outcome of those insecurities. The fact is, India is a soon to be 1.3 billion population country. It's a nuclear power. It is a fast-growing economy. And it has global interests. India matters to the world in ways that it never did before. And don't take it from me. I hear this when I meet with people from Japan, from Israel, from Sri Lanka, from the UAE, from Saudi Arabia. They're all looking at India in new ways. And this is really a testament to India's growing clout. Now, the question is, can we seize upon those opportunities? India is very well positioned for the world, a world that is in flux. We're seeing a West that is looking inward. We're seeing a China that is being expansionistic. And what have we seen happen? I think some of the co-panelists have, I think, either neglected or don't seem to be aware of some of the significant developments that have taken place, not just in the last 3 years, but even prior to that. India is the country that has stood up more to China than any other country there is. India did not go to the Belt and Road Summit in May. It articulated why, and subsequently, several countries, including the United States, have now signed on to India's view of those concerns. India is now facing off with China in a third country. This is very significant. So I think while we may be still having these debates about how the world is the world is not paying attention to us, the world is paying attention.
Both the examples given have happened very recently, and we still don't know how long it will hold. On Bhutan, it's not as if we are standing with Bhutan today. We have been with Bhutan on the matter of where Bhutan demarcates its boundary with China for years. And China is aware of it, so it's not that we've suddenly grown new muscle and are exercising. So let's make that point clear. On the question of the One Belt, One Road, CPEC, I mean, which country can become part of a project where a road is being built through territory without your permission, which you claim as your own? Would China allow it when the Dalai Lama goes to Arunachal Pradesh? You should see the language they use against us. So I think it's not a sign of great, muscular energy that has come into it. It's the right decision, but it's still not enough to deal with China, because China's policy to India is absolutely clear. Containment with engagement.
Correct.
Pakistan's policy to India is absolutely clear, which is explosive aggression and tactical appeasement. Do we have a policy that is clear to both these countries?
To follow up on what you said, there were 9 other countries that also opposed India's entry into the NSG, correct? As Professor Karnad points out, we have to pursue our own interests. I want to go back to my opening question. Over 60 countries visited. I'm assuming a lot of goodwill generated, a lot of backroom diplomacy. Yet, despite that, we were taken off guard when it came to the meeting at the NSG over India's admittance.
I think one of the problems was, and I spoke about insecurity. We have a generation that is afraid of failure. And if the choice was to try and to push India's case as much as possible, and know that it will meet resistance, it was known beforehand that China was going to oppose it. And if the alternative is to not try at all, well, half of winning is just showing up.
It's interesting that we knew beforehand that China would oppose, and then we
still went ahead.
Still asked our prime minister, whether we disagree with him politically inside the country is another matter. He is our prime minister, and when he goes outside the country, whoever he meets, whether he's meeting Xi Jinping or he meets the president of the Maldives, he is our prime minister. For us to send him and to...
He went of his own volition. Yeah.
When he met, you
don't send him. The prime
expose minister. Your prime minister. Right. Outcomes of that.
All right, I want to go across to Justin. Justin, I want to go back to the original question. Over 60 countries visited. We'll at least have to admit India has changed the projection of India. At least under Prime Minister Modi's leadership, India has been projected as the next big economic investment after China.
That's certainly the way it's perceived in Britain. I mean, Britain's policy now is based around the idea that India will be a key part of Britain's economic future. So post-Brexit, we're one of the many countries coming cap in hand to India, hoping to do trade deals. And in fact, India's in an incredibly powerful position. There's a hell of a lot of leverage it can use with powers like Britain. And there's a huge opportunity there. Whether Modi is... he's certainly been very reluctant to talk in any detail about any plans. I mean, obviously, there are restrictions on what Britain can do. But he's certainly keeping his powder very dry, and quite rightly, because I think these are the great opportunities here for India in relation to countries like Britain.
Okay. But Dr. Sharma, I want to go back. We talked about the Trump visit. You said it was a success. But on the other hand, we're not sure where Donald Trump stands on China. On the other hand, India's relations with China are worse. India's relations with Pakistan are worse. China's relations with Pakistan have improved because of Pakistan's involvement with the Orob summit. Russia, we can't depend on Russia. The U.S. is unpredictable. How have we gotten into this position?
Oh, no, I think you should see it in the perspective. Before he went to Germany, he had visited... Moscow, he had St. Petersburg, he'd met Putin. And then after that, he met Trump. He'd met Merkel. You see, all of them look up to India, and I agree with the point that at the present flux in the global relations, India is far more acceptable. And we should speak. I would like to slightly change the nuance of Justin to say that we are not trying to be a bit pushy about it, but we should be content that we are far more acceptable to the world. You see, we don't carry with us any grievance. We don't carry chips on our shoulders. We don't bring to the table any baggage like some other countries, big or small, bring. Now, this has been so for last several years. Prime Minister Modi's good point is that he's harnessing that acceptability. And that's the reason why he visits anywhere.
But it's been 3 years, sir. It's 3 years now. We need to move on beyond that.
Yes, but foreign policy, in foreign policy, it is not a piece of cloth. You can't meter it. All you can do is give your input. The outcome depends upon other people's actions. And this is where the flux is today. Did you predict Trump's arrival in the U.S. just last year?
All right, Mr. Khurshid, let's ask you that question. Surely we have to cut this government some slack. There's no way anybody, most like national global capitals, could not have predicted that Donald Trump would win this election. They didn't, and they were caught on the back foot. So this government, too, over the last 2 years has been investing in the U.S. They've become a military, a diplomatic ally of the U.S., and that is why we're seeing the reactions we're seeing from China today.
The easiest thing to say for the government is it still thinks in progress, and that we should really give them a little more time and then ask them to account for what they've done. But if you take a midway progress today, I think despite enormous amount of energy and focus, we don't have anything to show for it. Whether we agree or we disagree with the movement and the direction that he has taken, the fact remains that today even those who give credit to the Prime Minister are talking about moving away from strategic relationships to transactional relationships. Now, transactional relationships is all we have after 3 years. For me, that's very disappointing.
But that's being driven by Trump, not by India. I mean, India built a very good relationship with the previous administration, and you saw an increasing depth of, you know, relationship militarily, economically. I mean, there was huge progress. The American ambassador, Richard Verma, said Indian-American relations were better than they'd ever been. They were closer partners than they'd ever been. And actually, the logic of the relationship between India and China and America is that Trump is going to want to be close to India for all the reasons that we've already discussed.
Trump would want to be closer with India, but on the issues where there was engagement under the Obama government and our government here, let's say climate change, let's say exchange of technology, Trump has been really lukewarm.
Yeah, but that's nothing. The climate change position is not to do with India, is it? I mean, that's a decision Trump's made unilaterally.
I think it was useful.
Hold India responsibility.
I think it was very useful, and I think I would credit the Prime Minister for having met with President Donald Trump as soon as he could. America is one of our most important strategic partners, and for Mr. Trump to meet with Mr. Modi on a one-to-one basis was important. But I think one of the great obstacles here was that Mr. Trump's own State Department hasn't settled down yet. There isn't a coherent policy as yet which is visible. But a beginning must be made, and I think it should be taken forward. I would have been happier if Mr. Modi had been able to persuade Mr. Trump, in spite of all his rhetoric on containing terrorism, to put a little more pressure on Pakistan, for instance. It's the only country that can exercise the requisite influence on Pakistan, $25 billion US dollars in aid, military or civil, in the last 10 years. America can exercise that influence, and perhaps this visit will push America towards doing it. I mean, they make Salahuddin. They declare him to be a global terrorist. And a few days later, Pakistan cocks a snook at America and has Salahuddin talking to a television channel in Pakistan saying that he can unleash terror.
But that was no different under the previous government.
The same thing with Hafiz Saeed.
Exactly.
America has put a $10 million US dollar bounty on Hafiz Saeed, and they can see him operating
freely
in the manner in which he does, even from jail, running his terrorist network. So America doesn't need to be convinced. America needs to be persuaded to act.
I think you have to agree that the Prime Minister is trying his best. This guy, Trump, is an unpredictable sort of chap. And as Pavan
says, unpredictable that you don't even put a demand for H-1B visas, for example?
No, I think, you know what, I think the H-1B visa was important, but when you go and meet the leader of one of the most powerful countries in the world, you do not talk about H-1B at that point of time. There are very, very important, it's a very important issue.
So it's a long-term relationship,
absolutely.
And H-1B
and you
visas
have
will
to
have
let,
to...
I think you also have to allow Trump to walk the talk. And also I would like to say to Mr. Salman Khurshid, who we all know well, it's not as if the UPA's foreign policy was, you know, milk and honey, and I'm not referring to Israel. But for example, the Bangladesh, and you know, Firdausi comes. Now, look at what happened in Bangladesh. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh went to Bangladesh. It was supposed to be an amazing visit, except the UPA couldn't get its act together, could not persuade Mamata Banerjee to come on board, and therefore it was a minor disaster. And to Justin's point about India's sort of, you know, hoping to feed into the post-Brexit phenomena in Europe, I would also imagine, I think some of it is what the Prime Minister is doing, is engaging with the world. But what about back home? I think the systems at home, for example, we're still so compartmentalized between the Ministry of Finance, External Affairs, you said climate change, environment. Nobody's really talking to each other. So that's another aspect of foreign policy, if you like.
Mr. Khurshid, so at least this Prime Minister is less politically hamstring than Prime Minister Manmohan Singh.
It's all very, very well to say that we couldn't achieve something and the Prime Minister is at least trying to achieve it. I think for me, foreign policy, and I agree with various commentators who say that foreign policy is about self-interest. Now, there can be self-interest and there can be enlightened self-interest. I don't see India being perceived today as a country with enlightened self-interest alone. which is what will give in India the stature, the place in history that, that the Prime Minister is looking for. And I think that, that requires an attitudinal change from simply getting everything together in a transactional arrangement and then tom-tomming it and saying, look, we now have such a wonderful relationship. I think we need to add a lot more substance, and we've got to do it very quickly.
Professor Karnav, if you're talking about enlightened self-interest, will the visit to Israel count as that?
Yes, but if you have, you have to have a security architecture. Well, security architecture has to be that Israel is one anchor in the West. The other anchor of the architecture is Japan. You see, this is geostrategic design that you have to have in mind and which should underlay your policies. This is precisely the problem. We don't have a vision. It hasn't been articulated, not by this prime minister, not by previous prime ministers. And I don't think the MEA has done it over the years. It has just sort of carried on in the manner that perhaps in the Nehruvian sense of being friends with all. And that doesn't help. When you try to subsume universal good as your foreign policy aim, then universally you're appreciated, but your own interests don't get served. This is the problem,
isn't
it? But
is that what this government is doing with Israel?
I am a student of Chanakya, and I think that going to Israel, I mean, I know Salman and I have disagreed on this in the past, but I don't think this enlightened self-interest is one of those conundrums of foreign policy. There's a national self-interest. To some people it may look enlightened, and to some people it may not, but the fact is national self-interest is verifiable, identifiable, and pursuable. Now take the case of Israel. There's a sequence to it. Relationships began 25 years ago, but in a Congress government,
Prime Minister Narasimha Rao.
Since then, there has been an evolution in that relationship. In this government, you had the President of India visit Israel in 2015. Just 2 months ago, you had the President of Palestine visit India. Before going to Israel, Prime Minister Modi went to the UAE, to Saudi Arabia, to Qatar, and to Iran. So there's a sequential arrangement of it. Now with Israel, if India can gain in term in its defense, in the area of defense and in the area of counterterrorism, then I believe it's our national self-interest to pursue it, and pursuing that national self-interest does not mean we are letting down the Palestinians and our consistent support for their just cause. So I am not very clear what enlightened self-interest means.
So, Dhruv, is this just continuity of foreign policy or a masterstroke by this government under Prime Minister Modi?
I think there's been a lot more continuity than both parties, both major coalitions have admitted in many ways. They've also been very important breaks, and the breaks have happened at various points of time. There were some significant breaks under Prime Minister Vajpayee in the early 2000s. There were some significant breaks under Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, the nuclear agreement in 2005 with the United States. Some of the movement with Japan happened really at that time. Of course, some of this goes back even earlier to Narasimha Rao in Israel, and the Look East policy was really quite under him. We have seen a certain number of breaks here in the last few years as well. Some of it is really an outgrowth of, as Jyoti rightly pointed out, the Prime Minister simply having the political capital. He's been able to take a number of initiatives with the US, China, Bangladesh, and others just across the finish line. But in other ways, we have seen some important paradigm shifts. And it's interesting that Professor Karnad brought up the security architecture, because while we haven't seen a statement from the MEA or any other part of the government that has clearly delineated what India's grand strategy is, if all you have to do is connect the dots, and if you look at the relationships that have really improved in the last few years, you see the beginnings of a security architecture: Israel, UAE, Singapore, Vietnam, Japan, and this is and also down into the Indian Ocean. I think somebody mentioned earlier that this government doesn't have an Indian Ocean strategy. I'd suggest you all read the 2015 speech in Mauritius made by the Prime Minister, which articulates to this date perhaps the most the clearest set of intentions that India has in the Indian Ocean region. So I think we are seeing some very important developments taking place in the last few years, but they're building on developments that previous governments have contributed to.
May I just say, the fact is that we have had these initiatives with the Look East, Act East, Southeast Asian nations, and so on. Now, this has been on the agenda for the last several governments, not just this one. What have you done? I mean, Shinzo Abe came here at the very beginning of this government's term, and so did the Vietnamese foreign minister and the prime minister and so on. They keep visiting. But we do not put out. There is no substance. There's just a rhetoric, right? Look east, act east. I'm sorry. The point is this. The Vietnamese have been, we are promising them the BrahMos supersonic cruise missile. I've long suggested that we should really give them the nuclear warheaded BrahMos. Why nuclear warheaded? Because that's at one, in one instant, it will basically, in a sense, neutralize the entire powerful South Sea fleet based in Hainan, right? We don't have the guts for it. Right? We don't have the gumption for it. And we are not willing to even transfer the conventional warheaded. We just talk about it for the last 3 years. We haven't done it.
You know, Bharat,
I want to go back to Israel, but I want to give you a chance to respond. When we talk about Look East, India said we're not going to attend that inaugural summit of OROB in Beijing, but six of our neighbors did, and they signed at least 20 agreements. Isn't that a failure?
We
have a neighborhood which is not, which does not dance on your tunes. Each of them decide to do things.
No, but
so you have to live
one of the
that
pillars of your policy
you
has been
them.
The neighborhood first you and cannot, look east
you cannot
or
prevent,
act east.
You cannot prevent your neighbors from going to wherever they are invited. You cannot prevent that. That's the reality. The second point I want to make is that Bharat Karnad's suggestion that arming Vietnam with nuclear warhead, are we out of our mind?
No, we would be very much within our national interest.
And
if we
then
did that.
China,
you can't, we can, you can't
then China
warhead.
Tells North yes, Korea.
We can have a separate debate on that.
China transfers nuclear technology to Pakistan. We don't want to be a proliferator.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean,
Dr. Singh, you're saying that we cannot persuade our neighbors not to attend the summit. Then what is the use of all these visits? What is the use of calling these world leaders for a Republic Day parade?
We cannot even transfer nuclear power reactors because of the energy constraints. That's the reason why we were trying to get into energy, and we continue to maintain our thrust. Because the nuclear order is such that we have to make gains slowly. And, it's like you're leaning on a friend who's collapsing. He's not going to take what you want, what you want to give him. So let's
which is this
hold
collapsing
our breath.
Friend?
Vietnam is on its own, and we should be partners, strategic partners with them, but not burden them with our hawkishness.
I want to go, we dropped off on Israel. So, Justin, I want to ask you, the fact is ultimately what Israel wants from India is more than the trade, more than the hugs, the barefoot walks on the beach, the fact that they want diplomatic backup. And are we seeing India now supporting Israel and international fora like the UN?
Well, we'll have to wait and see, won't we? I mean, that's an interesting question and an interesting dilemma for India, definitely.
Would you like to answer that?
I have two questions, actually. The first is the UN Security Council. I don't know what's going on that. Britain, for example, why is Britain still a member? Sorry, Justin.
No, that's fair enough. That's a good question.
Or France, for that matter.
Or
why is
France
Security Council member?
I mean, it's been
member.
72 years since the end of the Second World War, and it's high time that we have a revamped Security Council. Now, I know that the pragmatists in the previous government
would
say...
What do you expect Prime Minister Modi to do about it?
I think you have to get your...
Because I think the mistake all governments have made is to beg for it. I'll tell you one thing.
Yes.
When countries say that we legitimately need to belong to the Security Council in a changed world, and without us, the United Nations is incomplete and also very often ineffective, it has a far greater impact then are going with a begging bowl to the five permanent members who will never allow the system to change. You must be realistic about foreign policy.
Yes, absolutely. My second question is on Africa. I think we've completely, in this debate, we haven't talked about Africa at all. And what is India's policy on Africa is something that I'd like, somebody to answer.
With Africa, the present juncture, the thrust in Africa is continuing. So
that's a real continuity. And I would give the credit to the Congress governments rather than this.
No, but you
but
have
this
government
has carried on the mantle.
No, well, I'm just wondering, you have so many hundreds and thousands of African students in India. I'm not sure that things are going very well with them.
I'd like to talk about our relationship with Nepal. No, look
with
after
Nepal.
Your own backyard first.
Exactly.
Look
neighborhood
after your
first
own
policy
backyard.
Isn't working.
There does need to be a strategic vision that engages with One Belt, One Road, because there you've got a policy from China that essentially encircles India, draws in all the neighbors, as we've already discussed. I mean, it's a huge you know, potential diplomatic threat to India. And there needs to be a coherent strategy to begin to deal with, to pick off the neighbours that China's approaching through
and
the policy.
And there isn't one now.
I can't see one, obviously.
All right, we're running out of time. Let's get some quick reactions, questions if you have. Let's take them one after the other.
I have a question. It is related to the policy of China, that basically in our neighborhood we are seeing that China is pursuing very deep developmental policies. It is embedded there with the governments of who are our neighbor. How India is actually, countering that, and how, it has changed or modified, if any, has been in foreign policy of India.
Dr. Sharma, you want to respond?
Yes. The Hambantota in Sri Lanka, they first asked India whether we would develop.
Yeah.
And we did not do that. Maldives also came to us for something. We couldn't take it. So they are the neighboring countries who ask us for things. But at that time, we are on a different track. The implementation ability of our government, as I think Jyoti mentioned, the domestic, the sum total of your domestic prowess, that determines your foreign policy. The whole purpose of foreign policy is that this domestic prowess increases, and we want an environment in which this domestic capability constantly increases, comprehensive development.
And I'll give a simple example. You talked about the flashpoint now on the border with China. Over the years, consistently, China has developed an infrastructure on the border, which compares so massively in favor of China against the infrastructure we have on our side. There are roads right up to the border. These are motorized roads. You can make the journey from Lhasa to Sikkim, the border of China has in the tri-junction, in 8 hours. All I'm trying to say is that a country that takes 10 years to set up a mountain brigade because of delays in financial approvals in this sensitive area, where we know China has the greater muscle, man to man and weapon to weapon, and it's an aggressive power. I think it's time we had a full-time defense minister also.
That's one way to start, certainly. All right, let's get two quick last audience reactions and then closing arguments for all our panelists.
Hello, good evening. I have two questions that from 3 years, what have really India achieved? Mr. Prime Minister Modi has been keep traveling to the countries, and still the people of the country is not happy. Like they're just saying the Prime Minister Modi just keep talking and doesn't do anything in action. And the second question is mine, that why did Mr. Modi didn't visit the Palestine first, and he went to the Israel and to talk to with the problem and to see the people of the Palestine and to talk with them. And so between the peace, Israel and Palestine.
Where are you from?
I'm from Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. So I disagree. I disagree with you that I think Indians actually like to see our prime minister on the global stage as a world leader. So even though we have elections coming up, I don't know if international travel will stop. But Pavan, would you like to respond to that?
The fact
that this time the prime minister didn't go to Ramallah meet the Palestinian leadership.
I don't think that we are letting the Palestinians down, because there have been recently at least 4 international resolutions in support of the Palestinian cause, which India has voted for. In support. Now, it doesn't mean that your hyphenation is such that if you go to Israel, you must go at the same time to Palestine. So I gave you the example. The president had come here in May. We have reiterated our support for the Palestinian cause. But again, I believe that we should not try to please everyone. While in Israel, if the prime minister made a statement speaking only about the validity of Palestinian rights, although there was a sentence of for just and durable peace, I think we would have fallen flat between both stools. Neither please the Palestinians nor please the Israelis. You must carry out a pragmatic foreign policy without unduly curtailing your principles.
All right, go ahead.
I think one of the areas that we have really not spoken about is Latin America, the resource capital, the resource belt of the world in the future. We have not been able to actually exploit, that's a wrong word maybe, but our diasporic connections with countries like Suriname, whose prime minister, whose vice president came down, but only thing that we could send is yoga and Patanjali products.
South America is also there because there are some countries that prime minister still needs to visit. they should leave.
Well, let's focus on neighborhood first and look east, act east. Go ahead, quickly.
Yeah, my name is Agri Zayefara, our IT student with KK Modi Stratford. I'm from Nigeria. For the past 2 years, I've been in Delhi. I think in 2015, 45 African leaders were in Delhi for the All African Summit. That's the biggest gathering outside of the UN and the Commonwealth where you see African leaders gather at that level, at the level of heads of government. We have a lot of African students in India, all over India. We come in search of technology transfer in terms of education and medicals especially. And India has been doing has done very well in terms of their contributions and electronic medicine in Africa with a lot of interaction. But the point is that India is not really opening up culturally to the world, just because China, they cannot compare in terms of China's infrastructural development all over the world, especially in Africa. But India needs to open up her space culturally and define a cultural strategy so that they can integrate better. Thank you.
Well, I think some of us are arguing we have too much of a cultural strategy and not yet of a strategic strategy. But I want to just now give all the panelists a chance to have a closing argument. How do you deal with a muscle China in a post-America world?
We have to deal with China carefully, steadily, but not obstreperously, because China wants to drag you into the loud center stage where the Global Times is determining things. I want to tell you that when someone tries to drag you into the jungle, the hunter becomes very quiet, and the big mammals, when they get into jungle, they do it very quietly. They don't make a big noise.
So who's the mammal and who's the hunter?
Well, you decide.
Mr. Varma, the strategic silence by the MEA is a strategy. It's not that we don't have a strategy.
Anyway, the question that you asked, I'll answer.
Okay.
I think we should endeavor to have the best of relations with China, which is our neighbor and an important neighbor. But I think every self-respecting country pursues its foreign policy to the extent possible within the framework of equality and mutual self-respect. And I think on that score, we have been lacking. Just the trade surplus China has with India can finance the entire One Belt, One Road initiative.
But Jyoti, what do you do when you're in a post-America world where you don't know if America will even come to your support?
Sarah, are you sure that we're in a post-America world? And that's a question that we're all asking.
Well, we're
asking,
in a world
right?
where we don't know if Trump will come
exactly.
to your aid.
Exactly, whether Trump is going to come to
your
aid. You
go head-to-head with China or any other, Pakistan.
Or Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the whole AFPAC area. I think you have to, in that situation, you have to engage with everybody, which means you must engage with China, you must engage with the Americans, whether you... You know, whether you're as comfortable with Donald Trump
and Russia,
or not.
Very important country.
With Russia. Look at the relationship between Russia and China. Mm. It's not very comfortable right now. And I think you cannot not engage with the Chinese. And, you know, to my African friends' question about India expanding its cultural space, I think that's one way of engaging with China, is that, you know, they have China has Confucius centers all over the world. And I think India sort of has some Rabindranath Tagore centers as well, the Jawaharlal Nehru centers. But imagine if India and China were to engage culturally. I think that would be really fascinating. And I think you have to use people, well, use is a bad word, but through people-to-people interaction. And I would say that's what we should do in South Asia. China is one neighbor of India, just like the others. So I think, you know, using people, whether in Bangladesh, in China, in Pakistan, Sri Lanka, I think that would be one way of doing it.
Professor Karnad, your last closing argument.
Yeah, well, you know, we have been on the wrong track. So wrong. I mean, look at our threat perceptions. Pakistan is our main preoccupation. That wretched nation is 1/7 of the GDP, 1/5 of population, one God knows what of everything else. I mean, it's a fraction of India's power, and yet here we are, we go,
obsessed,
you know, worked up about Pakistan, and China sort of sits there, is looming there, and we talk, do nothing about it. What I say is that China should be our main preoccupation, our main threat focus. We should try and co-opt Pakistan in whatever way we can, and we can very easily do that if we only had the right policies. And we should get out of this idea of leaning on some big power. Just about everybody here seems to want to lean on some big power. America, what will Trump do? Well, why should Trump do anything? India is not his constituency or his country, for God's sake. Do we elect him? So we don't need to rely on anybody. I think we have this sense of being a vine, a grape vine. We need a tree to wind ourselves around and to rise. We have to stand by ourselves, which we haven't done, because there's this lean shift, as I call it, from Russia to America now. I mean, just a small little statistic. But someone said here earlier, oh, we are a young country and we should represent a new generation and so on. I'm sorry, but 60% of the young generation, so-called, that was surveyed said they'd get the hell out of the country if they were given half a chance. So what is the foreign policy then, eh?
I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that survey, but I do agree. We're definitely not in a post-America world. You can't expect to rise with other countries. I completely agree with that. What you do is you look at the mutual interest between countries and make arrangements based on that. And actually the rise of China and the threat that China presents to lots of countries around the world represents an opportunity for India to make partnerships with other countries. And so India needs to leverage its new economic power, its new influence in the world through triangulating the power that China's projecting in the world, and this is a huge opportunity, I think, for India.
All right, so I think that's a good note to end, because we're completely out of time. It's an opportunity for India, and hopefully India will be able to make the most of it. Thank you so much for joining us on We the People. Thank you. Good night.